Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did America become a nation of news junkies? While we in the journalism profession might like to credit the noblest efforts of the late 19th century muckrakers, our addiction to information has origins both humbler and far more bizarre. In the 1830s, the New York Sun became the first penny paper in an era when the city's respectable publications cost six times as much. The cheap price meant working class readers could suddenly afford the luxury of a daily newspaper, sold on street corners for entertainment value as much as for solid information. When the Sun's flamboyant British editor published a series of satirical articles about outrageous forms of life discovered on the moon, sales skyrocketed, and the story traveled around the world. People were hooked on newspapers, even as evidence mounted that readers couldn't trust everything they saw in print. Matthew Goodman tells the whole story in his new book called The Sun and the Moon, the remarkable true account of hoaxers, showmen, dueling journalists, and lunar man-bats in 19th century New York. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I have to thank you, first of all, for allowing me to say lunar man-bats multiple times today.
That's not a phrase that naturally comes to the tongue, I think.
Oh, but I'm going to add it into my vocabulary.
Yes.
So the first newspapers in New York were sold by subscription, and I gather most of the readers were sort of wealthy. But then Benjamin Day had this great idea to democratize the industry by cutting the price.
That's exactly right. Benjamin Day was a very young, he was about 23 years old, printer, working-class guy, who in 1833 started a newspaper that he called The Sun. It was a very, very different kind of newspaper than the other papers that existed in New York at that time. There were 11 daily papers in New York, 7 morning papers, and 4 evening papers. As you mentioned, they cost 6 cents a piece, which sounds to us like not very much, but in point of fact was a lot of money. At the time, and they were directed really at the elite of the city, at the merchants, the aristocrats, and so forth, and their coverage really focused on the types of topics that these people would be interested in. So, you know, you had articles about, you know, commodity prices and the international economic situation and ships launchings and so forth, but Day took a very different approach, and he decided that he was going to cover the kinds of stories that the mass of New Yorkers wanted to read.
So he had a taste for what mass audiences wanted to read, and he was also politically independent in a way that was unusual back then.
That's right. I mean, first of all, what Day did was he decided to cover crime. He gave a lot of attention to crime stories. He started a column called the Police Court column, which was basically a dramatic rendering of the cases that had appeared in the police court the night before. People loved it. People ate it up. They were able to sort of at an arm's length distance to participate, to see what these terrible crimes were like. And it became quickly the most popular part of the paper. But, you know, he also covered scandals. He covered gossip. He covered entertainment. He covered sports. The kinds of things that tabloid papers of today cover. It really was kind of creating the template for the tabloid papers of today.
And he made sort of a lucky find. He found this British guy who had not done well in his homeland to cover crime and courts in a way that everybody just loved.
That's right. That's right. The when Day started, he was sort of a one-man show. He was the editor. He was the publisher and so forth. But as The Sun became popular and began to grow, Day realized that he needed to focus really on the business side of things, and he needed to hire an editor. So in the summer of 1835, when The Sun was not quite 2 years old, he hired this guy named Richard Adams Locke to be the editor of the paper. Locke was an expatriate British journalist, had come to New York 4 years earlier with his wife and his young child. As it turns out, this was not so widely known at the time, but he was a political radical who had basically been forced to leave England because of his political views. And he had had a big hit with The Sun on a freelance basis a few months earlier. There had been this sensational trial in New York, and this was the kind of thing that The Sun loved. Its readers just ate up this kind of thing. There was a guy named Robert Matthews, who was a carpenter from upstate New York, who had decided that he was a prophet. And he renamed himself Matthias the Prophet. And he wore this long pink and green silk coat, and he carried a staff in his hand, and he walked around the streets of Lower Manhattan proclaiming his theology, which said that disobedient women and clergymen and men who wore spectacles were all going to go to hell. And he sort of developed this cult following among some of the wealthy people in New York. And he had a farmhouse that someone had given him in upstate New York where they all lived together communally. And he had a harem of women up there, six white women and one black woman. The black woman, by the way, was a former slave named Isabella Van Wagenen, who in later years would join the abolitionist movement and change her name, and she became Sojourner Truth. That's where we first discover Sojourner Truth, was a follower of this Matthias the Prophet. Well, one of his disciples was poisoned, and Matthias went on trial for his poisoning. So this had, like, you know, all the elements, you know, sex and depravity and murder and so forth that people loved, and the trial became a sensation, and Richard Adams Locke covered it for The Sun. And his articles were gathered together by day into a pamphlet, which his newsboy sold on the streets of New York. He sold a lot of copies, made a lot of money. And Day said to Locke, if you have any other ideas for a series that's going to be as popular as this one, let me know. And Locke went about trying to come up with an idea, and that's how he decided to write this Moon series.
Yeah, editors back then, we should say, were very different and very public in a way that they're not so much today.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You know, the papers of the time were very different than the papers of today. To begin with, they were only four pages long. Of those four pages, only one of which was a news page, and it wasn't the front page. It was page two on the inside. The other three pages were mostly just advertisements. The editor of the paper was almost something of a one-man show. He wrote most of the articles. He selected the letters for publication. He responded to the letters in the paper. He advised his readers about, you know, not just whom to vote for, but also what books to read and what plays to see and what foods to eat. And, you know, the success of a paper rose and fell on the personality of its editor. And as such, these guys were really larger-than-life figures in the city. They were very vain, very egotistical, very ambitious, intensely competitive, and they hated each other. You know, a lot of them just detested each other, and it was not at all uncommon for them to just break out into fistfights, you know, when they happened to pass each other on the street. That happened all the time. The editor of the largest of New York's papers, The Evening Post, was the great poet William Cullen Bryant, a very mild-mannered guy. But he once horsewhipped a rival editor when he happened to pass him on Broadway because he didn't like what the other guy had said about him in the paper. The other guy responded by beating Bryant on the back with his cane, which shattered, revealing a sword beneath it. It was a sword cane. And they were pulled apart by the crowd. This kind of thing happens all the time. The editor of a paper called The Herald, James Gordon Bennett, was attacked three separate times in a matter of weeks by another editor, James Watson Webb. The third attack was so vicious that forever after, Bennett kept a pair of loaded pistols in his office to protect him from any future attacks. Bennett and Webb each participated in duels, not with each other, with other rivals. You know, these guys, it was not uncommon for them to fight duels with each other. So, you know, in the subtitle of the book, I say dueling journalists, which was true both metaphorically but also quite literally.
You know, it's funny, Matthew, because until you got to the horse whipping, it sounded very much like the cable news talk show hosts of today.
Well, you know, or in some sense a little bit like the blogs of today.
Sure.
You know, where... you know, if you go to a blog like, you know, a political blog like Talking Points Memo or something, you know, they have a little bit of a staff, but, you know, you're really going because you want to hear the opinions of the guy who runs the blog. And that was really the case of, you know, with the newspapers. These editors were very much public figures. They were very well known on the streets of the city. They, you know, this guy, James Gordon Bennett, for instance, you know, he used his paper, The Herald, as something of a Lonely Hearts column for himself. He would advertise his own charms to his female readers in the pages of the paper. When he finally got married at age 45, he ran the news of his own honeymoon on the paper's front page. You know, these papers were, you know, really vehicles for these editors.
Well, it's amazing to think how much competition they had. That there were 11 daily newspapers in the morning and several others at night. I mean, that's the population of New York was only about 250,000 back then.
That's exactly right. You know, the combined circulation of these papers was only about 26,000. This in a city of, as you say, more than 250,000. They were part of the reason they were so intensely competitive was they were competing for a very thin slice of the city's potential readers. You know, the upper class of the city. And you know, the really revolutionary thing that Benjamin Day with the Sun was to say there's this whole mass of potential readers who are not being given a chance to read newspapers, and we're going to direct our paper at them. And that's when the Sun really began to grow, when its circulation really began to take off.
So enter Richard Adams Locke as editor of The Sun. He was aware that people had been closely following the story of Halley's Comet, which was being tracked by the astronomer Sir John Herschel.
That's right. There was a big interest in astronomy at that time. As you mentioned, Halley's Comet was about to reappear sometime that fall. Nobody knew exactly when, you know, for the first time in three quarters of a century. It was also, by the way, you know, we have to remember this is the 1830s. The United States was still a relatively young country at that time. This was the first time that Halley's Comet was ever going to appear over the United States of America. And so, it, you know, its arrival was greeted with a lot of patriotism, patriotic feeling as well. So there was a lot of interest in astronomy. Richard Adams Locke himself was an avid devotee of astronomy, what, you know, today we would call an astronomy buff. He read all of the astronomical literature and so forth. And his idea, well, some years earlier, he had been reading a Scottish scientific journal out of Edinburgh, and he read this little article called The Moon and Its Inhabitants, which was a piece about the efforts being made by various astronomers around the world to try to communicate with the inhabitants of the moon, whom they believed, you know, existed on the moon, by means of, you know, various stratagems, by building a huge geometrical design on the plains of Siberia, or building a huge canal and setting it on fire, some way that we could somehow communicate to the lunarians, to, you know, the inhabitants of the moon. So that provided the basis for Locke's series of six articles that began to run in the Sun in August of 1835.
So he wrote the first one expecting it to do well, but had no idea how this would really catch on.
Exactly. It was an utter sensation. It was six articles. The first article, it claimed to be a reprint from a Scottish scientific journal. The first article talked about this amazing new telescope, the most powerful telescope ever built, this so-called hydro-oxygen telescope. It didn't exist, of course. This was all from Locke's imagination, that had been created by the eminent British astronomer John Herschel at his observatory in South Africa. Now, there really was a Sir John Herschel. He really was a very eminent British astronomer, and he really was in South Africa, which, of course, Locke knew. And it was very convenient for him because South Africa was months away. But, you know, to get word to South Africa was months in the doing. This is the days before the telegram. So it would be a long time before Herschel would even find out about these so-called discoveries that were made in his name.
We'll find out a little bit more about what the story was and what happened in just a minute. Matthew Goodman is here. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon, the remarkable true account of hoaxers, showmen, dueling journalists, and lunar man-bats in 19th century New York. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Matthew Goodman. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. If you've got a question or want to make a comment, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Matthew, the story comes out about the hydro-oxygen telescope, which is funny in itself because it just means water, I guess.
Yes, this was all purely out of Richard Adams Locke's imagination, but he was so erudite and he knew so much about science and astronomy that he made it all sound, you know, perfectly credible and believable, which was necessary once he started to describe the amazing things that Herschel was said to have found on the moon, which began with a field of poppies. That was the first thing that was seen on the moon. But then as the astronomers continued their observations of the moon, they began to find ever more incredible things, including various forms of animal life, starting with hairy bison on the moon, sheep on the moon, waterfowl, and then proceeding onward to unicorns were discovered on the moon, biped beavers, which are beavers that walk on their hind legs and build huts and have apparently discovered the secret of fire. And then in the crowning touch, at the end of the series, these four-foot-tall man-bats, lunar man-bats, Vespertilio Homo, as John Herschel was said to have dubbed them, these incredible creatures who are intelligent creatures. They talk, they fly, they build temples, they do art, and apparently fornicate in public, according to the Sun. Although the Sun, this is the Victorian age, of course, so the Sun didn't go into details about that, except to say that they're innocent creatures, but don't necessarily conform to our ideas of decorum.
That was some telescope.
It was quite a telescope, yes, the only one of its kind ever created. The series created an absolute sensation in New York. People absolutely believed it. Some estimates say that 9 out of 10 New Yorkers believed the series. One estimate said 19 out of 20 New Yorkers believed it. But people absolutely ate it up. They swarmed around the Sun offices waiting for the next installment of the series. By the end of the week, Benjamin Day had turned the articles into a pamphlet called A Complete Account of the Late Discoveries in the Moon, which sold for 12.5 cents. Day estimated that he sold 60,000 copies of this pamphlet, which is equivalent in today's population to over 1 million copies of that pamphlet. By the end of the series, The Sun, which was this little working-class upstart paper, had become the most widely read newspaper in the entire world. That's how popular the series was.
What's really amazing about this, Matthew, is that people weren't supposed to believe it, right?
That is the amazing thing that I've discovered in my research about this. The series was so successful that ever since then, any accounts of the series have suggested that its sole purpose was simply to sell more papers for The Sun, which I think was definitely true in the case of The Sun's publisher, Benjamin Day. But as I've discovered, that was not the motivation, at least not the primary motivation, of the guy who actually wrote the series, Richard Adams Locke. Now, in order to understand that, you need to understand a little bit of what astronomy was like at the time. This is the 1830s that we're talking about. And the field was dominated by religious astronomers. And these religious astronomers believed that not just the moon was inhabited, but all of the heavenly bodies were inhabited. The sun was inhabited. All the stars were inhabited. All the planets were inhabited. Because God, in his infinite wisdom, would not create heavenly bodies without also creating intelligent beings there to appreciate them. So this led to some, interesting speculation among astronomers about, what these various extraterrestrial creatures would look like. And so you had astronomers saying that, the inhabitants of Jupiter and Saturn would have enormous eyeballs to compensate for the dimness of the light from the sun. And one guy, this Scottish astronomer, Thomas Dick, suggested that the inhabitants of comets were a race of astronomers because they had a clear view of the solar system as they made their way around it and so forth. Well, Richard Adams Locke thought all of this was absolute nonsense. He was a religious freethinker who was opposed to any kind of religious control over the free scientific inquiry. And he thought that this sort of idea was very dangerous, as well as being absurd, because it affected the minds of young scientists. So he decided that what he was going to do was to satirize the ideas of these religious astronomers. If they believed that the moon was inhabited, he was going to give them an inhabited moon. And if they believed that the inhabitants of the moon were Christian, he was going to give them creatures who built temples on the moon, and so forth. And Garbinall, in the very language of these religious astronomers, in so doing, expose it for this, you know, great humbug that it was. But what he hadn't expected was that people were so schooled in the beliefs of these astronomers that they absolutely believed it when the series came out. And so they thought it was true. And then, of course, when it was revealed that Locke himself had written it, they called it a hoax. But it was neither. It was a satire. And Locke himself was deeply disappointed because it hadn't worked the way that he had wanted it to work. He called himself the best self-hoaxed man in New York.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Matthew Goodman is my guest. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon. Let's go to Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Hi. I was just wondering whether this story of lunar man bats might have, in some roundabout way, have inspired either Jules Verne in his science fiction later, or the astronomer James Lowell in his belief he had seen signs of life on Mars, the canals and everything.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's entirely possible. I don't know specifically if that's true, but you know, there have been stories about life on other planets and on the moon for centuries. You know, the ancient Greeks believed that the moon was inhabited. So Richard Adams Locke was really part of a wonderful tradition of what we would now call, it wasn't called this then, but what we would now call science fiction writing. I should mention, by the way, that amazingly, just 2 months before The Sun published its series, there was a young short story writer in Richmond, Virginia, who had written a story about a balloon trip to the moon and the lunar inhabitants that this guy discovered there. That story was called Hans Fall a Tale, and that writer was none other than Edgar Allan Poe, who becomes a major figure in the story as well. Poe, who was, you know, a very vain, intensely competitive guy, was convinced that the sun had plagiarized his idea, and he spent years railing against the success of the moon series compared to the obscurity of his own work. And 9 years later, when he first moved to New York, his very first order of business was to go to the offices of the New York Sun and place his own hoax in the pages of the Sun to prove his own superiority as a hoaxer.
And it's funny because he was getting away with it, but then he couldn't keep his mouth shut.
Who, Richard Adams Locke?
Oh, Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, that's absolutely true about Poe, yes. I mean, Poe was a very complicated character. And he planted this hoax in the pages of the Sun. And the next day, when people went to the offices to get a copy of the paper, he proclaimed himself as the editor, as the author of the story, because he was so proud of it. He just could not possibly let it go anonymously written. So that, shall we say, destroyed the effect of the hoax.
And hoaxes were not an uncommon thing around this time. You have some really interesting information in here, also tied in to Richard Adams Locke, about P.T. Barnum and what he was up to.
Yeah, this was really the age of hoaxes in America. It was part of really the democratizing trend that was going on in the society at the time. But, you know, as I've discovered, really amazingly enough, the very same month that the Sun's hoax appeared, there was a young showman who had just arrived in the city from rural Connecticut who had his own hoax in tow. As you mentioned, that young showman was P.T. Barnum, and this was his very first promotion. It was an elderly black woman, named Joyce Heth, whom Barnum claimed was 161 years old. And not only that, but she had been the nursemaid of the infant George Washington. And
It's not enough for her to be 161.
Exactly, exactly. She also had to be, you know, the nursemaid of the father of the country. But, you know, he promoted her all over the city, and New Yorkers swarmed by the thousands to come see Joyce Heth. She lay out on a couch. She was displayed on a couch, this very old, wrinkled woman. And she sang old church hymns, and she told stories about young George, and she told the story about the cherry tree, of course, which in her telling was a pear tree, but nonetheless, it was the same story. And people believed it, and it was the greatest hoax of its time. It and the Sun series were the two great hoaxes of their time, both happening in the same city during the very same month. And amazingly, the Joyce Heth hoax would eventually be exposed by none other than Richard Adams Locke in the Sun. So there was this whole kind of web of deceptions and counter-deceptions that were going on.
Well, and sadly for both Joyce Heth and P.T. Barnum, I guess, she may not have been 161, but she didn't live very long.
She only lived about another year, not even quite a year, after Barnum brought her to New York. And then really possibly the most bizarre incident in the whole series of bizarre incidents described in this book happens. P.T. Barnum announces that he's going to reveal the truth one way or the other of whether or not she really was 161 years old. And what he does is he holds a public autopsy of Joyce Heth, and he charges 25 cents admission. And New York, hundreds of New Yorkers arrive at a theater in Broadway where this public autopsy of Joyce Heth is performed. And Barnum, of course, made thousands of dollars, and it was revealed that, in point of fact, she was only 70 years old, not 161, as was claimed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Matthew Goodman is my guest this afternoon. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. Next on the line, we have Ryan in McKinney. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Matthew. I just had a question. I was wondering if maybe like the hoax with the moon might have inspired Orson Welles to do his War of the Worlds broadcast in, I think, 1936.
Right. Well, you know, Orson Welles had taken his idea from a story by the great science fiction writer H.G. Wells, no relation. But, you know, it's interesting, the very different reactions that were created by this. You know, the reaction to the Orson Welles drama, The War of the Worlds, of course, was great fear. And, you know, there were these tragic stories of people committing suicide because they thought that the Martians were attacking. The reaction to the Locke series was entirely different. It was pure delight. Of course, you know, we weren't being invaded by Lunarians. We were just observing them from afar. But people were absolutely delighted by the idea of these creatures inhabiting Earth's closest neighbor. They seemed like intelligent, peaceful Christian creatures, and they were our closest neighbors. And, you know, by the way, there was talk about whether or not they really were Christian or not. And there were even efforts by various Bible societies around the country to raise money from their members to send Bibles to the residents of the moon, just in case they were heathens and did not yet have the good word.
Well, there was all that fornication going on, so I guess
there
was reason to wonder.
Exactly so, exactly so.
Well, it's even funny the way that he would write about them and describe them, because he talked about them walking around in a most dignified manner or something.
Yes, no, I mean he clearly was having a great deal of fun with this. And as I said, people were utterly delighted to find out about these marvelous creatures.
So at some point, Locke has to sort of bring this to a close. So what did he do to end the series so that there would be no more dispatches from South Africa?
Right. Well, you know, he was in a bit of a bind because he hadn't really anticipated the remarkable effect that this series was going to create. As I mentioned, he really hadn't intended it to be a hoax at all. He had intended it merely to be a satire. But it was taken as a hoax. And so necessarily a great deal of speculation began to arise about whether it was true or not true, and if it wasn't true, then who had actually written it? Well, there was a good deal of speculation centered on him because he was the editor of the paper in which these stories had appeared. And so he was constantly being asked by people, did you write it, did you write it, did you write it? But Locke felt sort of honor-bound not to reveal it because he had been paid by Benjamin Day a lot of money for the series, and he felt that, you know, Day had rightfully bought the series and only Day could reveal whether or not it was true or not. So what happened is, well, part of what happened is that the series was so successful that the other papers in New York began to reprint it on their front pages, not wanting to miss out, you know, on all the uproar and the readership and so forth.
This is before copyright law, we should say.
There were no copyright laws. They were just able to just, you know, go right ahead and reprint it. One of the papers claimed that they were getting it from their own source in Scotland, just like the Sun had. So one night, Locke was out with a reporter from another paper called the Journal of Commerce, this guy named Finn. And they were drinking. Locke was a bit of a drinker. And they were getting drunk in the bar of one of the hotels in New York. And this guy, Finn, said to him, hey, we're about to start reprinting the series in our paper, the Journal of Commerce. And Locke, whose tongue, I think, had been weakened somewhat by the drink, said to him, don't do it. I wrote the series myself. And Finn, rather than take this as kind of a word to the wise, to a fellow colleague, instead took it as a scoop. And the next day, the Journal of Commerce printed this this article, Locke admits writing the Moon series, and that was it.
We will talk more about what happened after that with Matthew Goodman. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Matthew Goodman, whose new book is called The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. You can join us this afternoon by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. One of the other things, I guess, that happened, Matthew, was that this story finally, after some delay, got back to John Herschel.
That's right. I guess it was sort of inevitable that eventually Herschel was going to find out about it. The way he did find out about it was that there was a circus operator from New York named Caleb Weeks who had gone to South Africa looking for new and undiscovered animals that he could promote in his circus. He was the first person to bring the giraffe back from Africa to the United States. And he happened to be staying in the very same hotel in South Africa with John Herschel. He, knowing this, he had brought with him the copies of The Sun with Herschel's supposed discoveries in them, and he was something of a jokester, and he went to Herschel and presented him with the American reprint of his own wonderful discoveries. Herschel, needless to say, was rather surprised by the discoveries that had been made in his name, but read them with great interest and, I must say, with great amusement. He thought it was all a marvelous production and took it with great good humor, although I would say that within about a year or so, he began to feel somewhat less amused by it because he was getting letters from all over the world day after day after day by people saying, when are you going to tell us more about the great discoveries that you made on the moon? And by that point, I think he was really not quite so amused by it.
And he was worried, I guess, about his reputation.
Well, sure, because, you know, he the Herschel name was almost royalty in astronomy. His father, William Herschel, was an eminent astronomer in his own right. He was the one who had discovered the planet Uranus. He was the king's astronomer in England. Herschel himself was a very famous astronomer, perhaps the most famous scientist in the world at that time. His fame has been compared to Albert Einstein's fame. He was the equivalent of Einstein in the 19th century. And I think, yeah, after a while, he wasn't too pleased to have his good name wrapped up in, you know, what he considered to be this sort of bit of nonsense.
So what happened to Locke's good name?
Right. Well, that's sort of a sad story. You know, I must say that I have come to, I've come to know a lot about the life of Richard Adams Locke. He had been, not much had really been known about him before this, but I did a lot of research, and I really came to feel a good deal of affection and respect for him. You know, he was a marvelous writer, in his own way a great man, even though something of an unfulfilled man. And the author of this amazing literary production that really deserves to be better remembered today than it is. But unfortunately, he became known as a hoaxer, which, as we said, is not what his really what his intention was. He became known as the man in the moon. He was never really able to let go of this hoax. And things didn't really go very well for him in later years. He left the Sun. A year later, he got into an argument with Benjamin Day over money, tried to start a new paper of his own called The New Era, a radical paper with a scientific bent. He only lasted a few years there, and then he ended up getting fired. He began drinking more heavily. He became the editor of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, which was another penny paper. It only lasted a year there. His position was eventually taken by a young poet by the name of Walt Whitman, and eventually he left journalism entirely, and he spent the last 20 years of his working life at the New York Customs House inspecting ship's cargo, which was a pretty common place for writers who were down on their luck, and he ended up dying quietly and without any, I would say quietly and obscurely, in Staten Island across the water from New York City.
Were you able to learn whether or not he still sort of kept up with what was being reported in the newspapers?
He did. He absolutely did. He was involved in Democratic politics. He was, you know, very political. He spent a lot of time doing mathematics and doing science, but mostly anonymously. He really, I think, had had enough by that point of celebrity and notoriety, and he pretty much kept his name out of the papers as much as he could. When he died in the year 1871 at the age of 70, his death occasioned not a single obituary in any of New York's papers, not even the Sun, which he had done so much to help, the success of which he had done so much to help nurture. He was really something of a flash in the pan. He was someone who was famous, very famous for a very short amount of time, and then was basically obscure for the rest of his life.
Matthew Goodman is here. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Brenda in Dallas. Hi, Brenda.
Oh, yes. I just wanted to make a comment. I live in Cherokee, Texas, and how hoaxes can be perpetuated either through young children, a naivete, or people who aren't worldly. But anyway, I have a dry sense of humor, and my grandsons between the ages, I have 3, 2, and 6, I was able to perpetuate this hoax of a werewolf in the Calliope Bayous, which is just a lowland around where we live. And but it was only like 2 or 3 years after that that they became wise. But it's just, it's a fun, kind of fun thing to do. It's fun.
To pull off a hoax on somebody.
Oh, yes. I think, I just get the kick out of it, yeah. Because, like I said, I have a real dry sense of humor, so it just makes me happier than them.
Well, thanks for your call, Brenda.
It's easier to do than one might imagine to pull off a hoax like this. You know, Barnum, of course, made his career on such things. He became the most famous American, you know, to the rest of the world as a result of his hoaxes. And part of why is, well, it's easier to do it if the hoax in some way comports with some ideas that the hoaxee already has. And part of the reason why this hoax worked so well, as we discussed earlier, was because people were already primed to believe that there was life on the moon. So this idea just simply fitted into to a pre-existing system of belief that they already had.
Is it true, by the way, that P.T. Barnum did not say there's a sucker born every minute?
That is true. Hmm. He did. Most of the things that we think Barnum said, he really did say. He was an amazing guy, a really larger-than-life figure. He had a wonderful sense of humor and very, very wise in his own way. But in point of fact, you're right. He never did say there is a sucker born every minute.
Are you a fan of the verification sites like Snopes.com when you hear about hoaxes and urban legends now?
You know, I am, I would say. I have a good friend who just coincidentally is a Bigfoot researcher. He goes out on these expeditions. In fact, he was just in Texas, as a matter of fact, just a few weeks ago, searching for Bigfoot. And so I'm very avidly following the news about whether or not Bigfoot is actually going to be found.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. The book is fascinating because so much of what you write about really could be transformed with just a little bit of technology and feel very current, strangely enough.
Yes, absolutely true. I mean, you know, there are hoaxes that continue to go on today. I mean, the Internet is both an amazing creator and destroyer of hoaxes. I mean, this particular hoax wouldn't work so well in today's day and age because all you would have to do is email John Herschel over in South Africa and say, is this true or not? It really depended on there not being a long-distance method of communication. But, you know, we saw all kinds of hoaxes that were going on during the last political campaign that were being sent around virally by means of email. But, you know, one thing that really is very relevant to today is this whole idea of the conflict between science and religion. You know, as I mentioned, Locke was someone who really was opposed to any kind of religious control over science. That's the reason he wrote this series in the first place. And it's an issue that we, you know, still continue to see today in debates over, you know, evolution versus intelligent design or stem cell research and so forth. You know, these are still hot-button issues today, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're still talking about textbooks here in Texas and whether or not they should include evolution. And then there are thoughts about that really echoing to other states and other school districts because what happens here will happen elsewhere.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, Locke, this was the time actually when the idea of evolution was first beginning to be thought of. And part of Locke's distress, Richard Adams Locke's distress, was that he actually had some friends who were geologists whose research had led them to the belief that the Earth was, in fact, millions of years old and not only a few thousand years old, as the biblical scholars of the time suggested. And so they decided to give up their research because it was leading them to this very dangerous conclusion in their mind. And Locke was deeply distressed by this idea. And that was part of the impetus for him writing the series in the first place.
What a curious time, though, that you mentioned that people theorize that the creatures on Jupiter and the planets beyond would have large eyes because they would be adapted to the dark conditions. So they had a little bit of that sort of worked into what they believed, but they didn't fully understand. In other words, they still wanted to find kind of religious significance.
Yes. Well, that's right. I mean, there was some idea about you know, the natural adaptation to whatever conditions you're in. But of course, it was always phrased as, well, God will adapt his creatures to the conditions in which he places them. So, you know, John Herschel himself, independent of this series, John Herschel himself suggested that the inhabitants of asteroids would be giants owing to the low gravitational forces on asteroids. So, you know, there were all sorts of ideas about God adapting his creatures to the places in which he put them.
What happened to the circulation of the New York Sun after this big series? It obviously didn't stay at 35,000 a day, did it?
Well, it never went back down. It never went back down. The Sun became, as I mentioned, the most widely circulated paper in the world. And you would think that once this hoax was revealed, people would turn against the Sun and stop reading it. But in point of fact, that never happened. You know, in those days, people didn't really think that newspapers had to necessarily provide, you know, truth, quote unquote, all of the time. They were quite amused when it was revealed that this was a hoax, and they sort of tipped their hat to the creators of the hoax and took it all in great good humor, and the circulation of the Sun never went back down. The Sun continued as a paper well until the 20th century. It didn't end until 1966, I believe. You know, the famous saying, "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus," that was from the New York Sun in the 1890s. The amazing thing, really, was that the success of the Sun in the wake of the hoax really proved the viability of the penny paper, a paper that was sold for only 1 cent and meant for the mass of people. And you began to see then penny papers begin to appear all around the country, the Baltimore Sun, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, all of which continue today. This was really the moment, the 1830s into the 1840s, when America became for the very first time a nation of newspaper readers. This was the moment at which the newspaper became really a mass medium.
And is there a legacy today? Do you think the New York Sun is more present in today's tabloids like The Star and things like that? Or is it more present, in fact, in papers like the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the Times-Picayune?
Yeah, I mean, you know, The Sun was really actually a legitimate paper. It had great local coverage. It was kind of a crusading paper. It was one of the first papers in New York to oppose slavery, which was very unpopular in New York at that time. It was very strong on labor issues. It had a lot going for it, which was one of the reasons why it continued for as long as it did. And in its emphasis on the kinds of stories that people really wanted to hear about, the kinds of stories that were actually affecting their lives, coverage of crime, coverage of local issues, you really begin to see the template for the kinds of, you know, good local papers that we have today.
Matthew Goodman is my guest. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account, I get to say it one more time, of hoaxers, showmen, dueling journalists, and lunar man-bats in 19th century New York. Matthew, it has been a pleasure, and you're a great storyteller on the radio as well as in the book, so thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a great pleasure for me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.